Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hi, I'm Irene Watson. I'm your host today. Well, today I'm really delighted to be speaking on the phone with Laura B. Hayden. She is the author of a recently published book titled Staying Alive, A Love Story. The book is a memoir of hope and renewal that centers around Laura's search for meaning after the untimely death of her 49-year-old husband. Today, Laura is going to tell us of her experience during the time of his death, dealing with two young children, and how she was able to move on. But before we chat with Laura, I'd like you to know a little bit about her. Laura B. Hayden spent her childhood in Brooklyn, New York, and her teens in Enfield, Connecticut, where she went to teach high school and freelance for regional publications. She married, raised her daughter and son through her 30s and 40s, and was widowed before she turned 50. 10 years later, she began writing about the loss in a thesis that completed the requirements for the MFA in writing at Western Connecticut State University in 2010. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Irene.
Well, this is really going to be a neat conversation, I know, because, I was thinking about you, and you were a young widow. My goodness. That must have been really tough. You know, it's tough at any time that a woman becomes a widow, and I'm thinking of my own mother and when my father died several years ago. But she's older. She's in her 80s. But you were young.
Yes, and I certainly didn't see it coming. None of us saw it coming in the family. My husband was 49 years old. He was receiving some preventative treatments for blocked arteries, and his surgery went fine. And, you know, he was home for 2 weeks, and come to find out later, that's the critical time period, 14 days, in which, tragically, a blood clot can travel to one's lung. And I was actually getting him ready to bring him to the doctor when we saw the very initial and then quick signs of something being terribly wrong.
It must have been in a, you know, I can't even imagine how you would feel when, you know, the surgery was over and all of a sudden it's like, this is something is happening. This isn't right.
Right. And, you know, his mother was with me. She had stopped by that morning. And, I'm thinking that it was good that I had someone there. But when he complained of just a twinge behind his leg, to be honest with you. And then I was getting his coat and getting ready to go out to through the family room into the garage and get him in the car. And when I went into the family room, his mother was with him, and he was slumped in a chair. And actually, he had lost consciousness. That's how quickly this horrible physiological anomaly can happen. And the last thing he said to me, he did talk to me. He said, call the doctor, okay? And and at that point, I went to the phone and I knew something was wrong. I called 911. I didn't call the doctor's office that we were going to. And then when I returned to the room, that's when he had lost consciousness. Yes. And, you know, you wonder how you're going to, you know, you don't know how you're going to react in a situation like that.
Exactly.
And, I mean, if my memory serves me correctly, because it's such, you know, you're in crisis, I rotely, of course, called 911. They got there in, it seemed, no time. And I was asked to go into the kitchen while they worked on him in the next room. And, of course, I was trying to comfort my mother-in-law. We knew something was terribly wrong. And I just rotely called a sister-in-law who was working nearby to come over to stay with Larry's mom because I knew that I would be going to the hospital with him.
You know, you had mentioned earlier that you didn't see it coming. And I just kind of thought about that when you said that, and it's like, even though we do know that death is the end of life at some point, even with, you know, I'm thinking of older people because, you know, we do see it coming, but it's still, when death comes, we go through quite a series of emotions, don't we?
Yes, and you know, when my father had cancer, and we were pretty much told that he had 6 months to live, and yet he did wonderfully during that time period. My mother cooked very particularly for him so that he didn't lose weight.
Okay.
And at the same time, I can say that we knew he was dying for 6 months, and yet when he died, it seemed sudden. Because a few days before, things had been so much better.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So I think no matter what, it's sudden, because you just always think you're going to have another day.
Exactly.
You always think you're going to have another time.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. How old were your children, Laura?
My daughter was 11, and my daughter was 13 and my son was 11. They had just gone off to school. They had said goodbye to their father that morning and headed off to school that day. And like I said, we were thinking things were getting better. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Their father was better every day they came home from school. So, I mean, they certainly had no clue. And it's the last thing you want to tell your child, that their father has passed away.
How did that go, Laura? I know that you can talk about it now.
Mm. Well, like I say, that day took on a series of almost rote behaviors for me. And I was honestly told by the school system to come to school and get my children, that they best be told in front of either teachers or the principal that they knew, rather than be sent home to be told the news.
Really?
And I pretty much did what I was told to do. And a librarian of my daughter's school came to pick me up. And, you know, I mean, I think maybe that's because the school systems have no idea what the child is going home to.
Well, that's a thought.
You know what I mean? Because
yeah.
I really thought about that for a long time in retrospect. But, you know, my daughter was asked to go to the nurse's chamber,
uh-huh.
and I was there, and we were not alone. And I think, once again, that's purposeful.
Yes.
And, you know, it's... I really can't say how, you know, you don't rehearse it, but I knew that I couldn't sugarcoat it either.
Okay.
And it was very, very difficult for me to convey that to Emily. And yet when the people around me realized that, they took over. And I do remember a wonderful, wonderful person saying, when I really had lost it, you know, Emily, some children don't have a good father for...
Uh-huh.
13 days, and you had one for 13 years. And that has always stuck with me, because it was the most apt thing that could have been said at that moment.
Wow. It's, yeah.
Mm.
And I'm sure that you look at that and think, well, you know, where did those words come from?
That one wonderful, wonderful dear woman. And then brought Emily home, and my... brother-in-law and sister-in-law accompanied me to Connor School.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, Connor was only a sixth grader, and he was being pulled out of a rehearsal for a Christmas show.
Wow.
I mean, the first things that the teachers thought to tell him was that he hadn't done anything wrong.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, you know what I mean? And, you know, that was good for him to know, because he would have been probably the type of student who would have worried about that. But... once again, there was a lot of support around me, but it was, just a conversation I wish I never had to have had with him. And yet, I remember on the drive home, he, as only a sixth grader could, he just looked at me at one point, because I wasn't driving, and said, well, I guess Christmas just won't be as festive this year. And it's funny, because festive was one of his father's favorite words. So I mean, these are the memories now that comfort me.
Yeah.
Right then, now when I look back, I can say that I should have known that this 11-year-old would eventually be okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? That's what I see in that statement.
Yeah. The maturity came out.
Right, it's maturity. Resilience that you don't even know you're going to have. But, and also, I think age appropriately, that would be a huge thing at that point.
Yes.
2 or 3 weeks before Christmas, anticipating it day by day, as you usually know it, and in his world, that was, one of the huge things that was going to be affected.
Yeah.
Mm.
So there you are, Laura, a mother that just lost her husband, grieving yourself. You have a mother-in-law. You've got other family around. You've got these two children. You know, I don't even know what that would be like. I can only imagine it.
Well, you know, I have a good friend who lost her husband a number of years later, and she was older. And she said to me, I don't know how you did it with two kids. And I just instinctively replied that I don't know how I would have done it without two kids, because they gave me a purpose. They gave me a reason to get up in the morning and keep things in order and get their lives on track, you know. So I, you know, and they also have become continual reminders of our lives together with their father, and they pick up their father's traits. So for me, that was probably better than having just myself to take care of.
Exactly.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah.
Now, you know, the grieving process, we all, of course, go through some type of grieving process. Now, each one of you, you know, you as the wife, the mother, grieve one way, and, of course, the children would have grieved in different ways, too. And could you just sort of tell us the differences or what you observed?
Well, they definitely did grieve differently, and I grieved very differently. And, you know, I was also one to want to understand what my kids were going through. So, I did what I could of reading. And I did read that for children, and this has always stuck with me, they grieve age appropriately so that, well, I'm going to use Emily as an example. She was grieving as a 13-year-old, and then she'd eventually grieve as a more mature teenager and as a young woman and adult that she is now. And, you know, no one ever said to me that I would, or did I read that I would grieve as a 49-year-old, then a woman in my 50s, and now a woman in my 60s. But for them, you know, that was at least something that I knew, that this would be cyclic, and every stage of their lives, this would be coming back to them.
Interesting.
Whereas a widow, I think, is expected to some degree, culturally, get over it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Now, as far as them as individuals, I have a section in my memoir about each of them, and it really helped me, and they helped me with this writing about them, because we thought it would be helpful for others to understand their differences. And the, let's see, Emily's essay is called Backlash, because she seemed surprisingly in, I'm not going to say good shape, but she wasn't terribly visibly affected early on.
Interesting, because of a 13-year-old, it's like they're so unpredictably predictable.
Well, you know, in a very short time, she told me a few weeks later, oh, I have a boyfriend, you know, and I want you to meet him. And this, you know, age-appropriate boyfriend, religious instruction and all that. And she, I mean, even right through high school, very popular, class officer, very active, very good grades. And yet, about halfway through her college career, it hit her like a Mack truck.
Interesting.
It was
Years later.
It was years later, and she experienced severe depression and physical symptoms, emotional symptoms that we really had to work through her later college years. Whereas Connor kind of wore it on his sleeve from day one, his grief.
Now, do you think that the difference was because of the ages? Do you think it's because one was a girl and one was a boy?
Well, you know, early on I asked my pediatrician.
I did, because
I was concerned about Emily. I mean, you know when your child is happier than she should be.
Yes.
And he was funny, and my pediatrician was a good friend of my, both my husband and myself. Larry was the best man at his wedding, so I know I wasn't getting, you know, I know I was getting someone who really cared about her more than reading her charts. And he said, you know, Emily's been strong since the day she was born. So had she not been, I would think that this would be out of her character. But, you know, to certainly keep an eye on it, but not to worry. And yet, you know, I've learned now, past a decade later, something's got to give. And it did. And yet, the funny thing is she kind of has made her life's work helping children with issues. She's not a child psychologist. She's her field is child life specialist, so that children who are in hospitals who are facing a crisis, either a something concerning them or their parents, she will be the person who intervenes to try to allay their fears and make them feel more comfortable and help them understand what is going on or what has gone on.
Interesting how that her experience as this young teen has now turned around and she's helping others.
And I'm, you know, I can't say that that's the direction she would have gone in had she not gone through what she went through.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. Join us and hear both well-known and upcoming writers talking candidly about their life experience as well as the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, we strive to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are available 24/7 through direct podcast as well as MP3 download for your convenience. Please visit us on InsideScoopLive.com. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Interesting, isn't it? We just never know how we will ever act or react when an unexpected death occurs. Stay tuned because there's just so much more that we will be hearing from Laura and staying alive. And, you know, sometimes some of us, people look at life as a path. And our earlier experiences, you know, mold us the way that we're supposed to, and that's the way we're supposed to be. So who knows? Who knows? Now, okay, so your husband passes away. The funeral is over with, and then a new life begins. You're going back to work. The kids have to go back to school.
Right.
What happened?
I was lucky that I could go back to work. If I had to find a job then, I don't know, you know, I think that would have been another hurdle. It was necessary that I went back to work. My husband was too young for collecting retirement. But I was a full-time teacher, and I continued to be a full-time teacher, high school teacher. And I think, once again, that's why I had to look forward. I mean, when you're facing 100 students every day who are moving forward, you are not of much service to them if you're not doing that also. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
So I certainly think that that I was fortunate in having that to go back to. I didn't have to go job hunting. Happens that I worked in the same town that I lived in, so there was certainly a lot of community compassion and understanding. So, you know, those are the things that I'm grateful for in a situation that I wouldn't have chosen to be in.
Of course. What about the kids? Was it tough for them to go back that first day?
Well, you know, Larry died on December 8th, and, of course, they were home for, you know, a week or two, which then led to Christmas vacation. So they really didn't have to face going back until literally January 2nd. And at that point, they were ready. And if they weren't, they wouldn't have gone back. But and at that point, I was ready. I mean, I went back to work on January 2nd. I think the three of us dreaded that day, and yet the three of us survived it. And I remember Connor telling me a story. It wasn't that day, but a while later, that a boy had come up to him in his gym class and said, and once again, I think this is a very age-appropriate question for a sixth grader, even though it doesn't seem kind. He said, you know, I don't understand why there's like such the fuss. My grandfather died, and people weren't as upset about this. And Connor kind of heard the statement and just walked away. I mean, it wasn't confrontational about it. And recently, a mother of Connor's peer group from, you know, the boys that he went through college with said to me, because I did mention that in my book, and she said, I was so worried, was that my son? And, you know, it's not important who it was.
Exactly.
Right? And it wasn't her son, but it wasn't important.
Yeah.
And it wasn't important for me to give a name either, because in, you know, I've had a lot of time for reflection.
Yeah.
I realized that it was okay for that boy to say that. I mean, he was. That's exactly where he was. He wasn't. That wasn't a mean comment. It was a what's going on here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm.
And the, you know, I'm so glad that you're talking about age appropriate, because sometimes we just don't understand these kids. And, you know, for him to say that, that was so okay.
It was. And when I spoke to this mother just a few weeks ago, she was coming from the position that that was a mean thing to say, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I think when I did re-explain my thoughts on it, she kind of shook her head and said, maybe you're right.
Mm-hmm. So stages of grief. You know, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross many years ago, I just can't remember how many years ago, but it's been a long time ago, came up with the five stages of grief.
Well, I can tell you it was in 1969.
Oh, okay. I knew it was like, well, yeah, that's over 40 years ago. So, And that was something that really was a buzz in our society and culture, that all of a sudden Elizabeth came up with these five stages of grief. And this was really used extensively and intensively in the therapy world. Now, what is your opinion of the five stages of grief as Elizabeth Kubler-Ross presented?
You know, once again, I've done a lot of thinking and reading, and recently in our culture, those stages of grief are being questioned. And mostly because, and this was very surprising to me, when Kubler-Ross came up with that, she really meant for it to describe the stages for dying, not grieving. So that if you were, unfortunately, knew that, you know, you were terminally ill and you were not going to survive, the stages were meant for the dying, not the grieving.
You know, I forgot about that. I just, yes.
Mm. And I think it was,
that's right.
It was like an easy out for the culture to oversimplify and then start applying it to the grieving as well. And more recently, it's really being recognized that grieving doesn't necessarily have that acceptance stage or closure. And Kubler-Ross did recognize this. It wasn't a linear process.
Mm-hmm.
It could loop. You know, that definitely was true. And at the same time, I certainly don't feel as if it defines any path that either I or my children have taken. And I like to speak about ourselves and not everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and once again, this is going kind of against the process. Everyone grieves differently.
Exactly.
Everyone grieves very, very differently.
Yeah, and I think you're so right. I think that the grieving process, as Elizabeth Kubler-Ross presented, was, it's also as a model, you know, or a sample that, and it was really, it's really important to know that each one of us grieves differently. And so I know that one of the things that she, in her model, is anger.
Mm.
Were you angry?
You know, I can't say that I was, yes, I was angry that I lost my husband. I will say that.
Uh-huh.
But I was, I didn't know what to be angry at.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, now if I manifested anger, you know, I displaced it someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that that was a steady trait. But I know that some people kept saying to me, well, you know, why? Don't you ask yourself why? And I began to realize that it was a question I couldn't answer. So it became unproductive to ask it. And once again, I had my sights set on getting myself and my children through this, and I would say that anger wasn't part of a great manifestation in me.
The, I'm pleased to hear that, because I know that, you know, I've spoken to others that have lost a husband, let's say, for example, and they would go through stages where they would be super angry at him for leaving them, especially when they were going through some type of a crisis or something was difficult, or they were alone, and then they would project the anger on their deceased husband because it was, you know, his fault.
Well, you know, if he was a reckless driver and he died in a car accident, or if he had unhealthy habits that led to his health's demise, I could see that I might have done that. But I'm sure that the person that would have wanted, Larry wanted to live very much.
Of course.
He wanted to have many more years with us. So, I had no reason to be angry at him.
I think it is circumstantial, too. I agree with you. So,
yeah.
Laura, your life now. Tell me.
Well, you know, it's been 13 years.
I
miss my husband. But I'm so relieved to know that my kids are in good places. I'm certainly in a better place. And that doesn't mean we don't think of him continually. You know what I mean? And that's what I think that, once again, getting back to the model of acceptance, it's like, if anything, we may have grown stronger. I know I appreciate my living friends and relatives more now because I know things can change very quickly. It's a very kind of perverted gift that we have.
Do you ever just sort of sit back and reflect on your life, what it could have been if he was still alive?
I think that I do that in when I see my peers celebrating their 30th and 40th wedding anniversaries, going on cruises, planning their retirements. I find myself always looking for work because I guess I'm on a different path.
Of course.
Then that doesn't mean that that can't change, but I don't put myself in the places that I would have been with Larry that I can't be now.
Are you in a relationship now?
I have a very close friend, very dear friend, who happened to have raised his daughter after the death of her mother. It's just, you know, it's not the same relationship I certainly had with my husband. It's a different one, and we don't, neither of us try to make it be what would have been.
Yeah.
And then that really, it's a very different relationship.
Of course.
Yes.
I mean, you're two different people now.
Right.
And it's a totally different thing. And do you ever see yourself settling down with this person?
Well, you know, that, in, I would have to say, if I did, it would be in a probably less traditional way.
Sure. And, you know, of course, it's whatever you choose to do and whatever feels right for you at this point. Yeah. How do your children, now that they're older and, you know, young adults, how do they accept your relationship with this good friend of yours?
Oh, they're very accepting of it. Yes, very accepting. You know, sometimes your children can be more mature than the parent. And
that's a scary thought.
Actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I'm thinking, well, where am I going to go with this? But at the same time, one thing that my friend and I both agreed with about raising children who have lost a parent is that their needs are more important than the surviving parents' needs. Okay, this may be something that definitely drew me to my friend also. And both of us being on that wavelength, nothing ever interfered with any of our kids being the first love of their lives. So, and that works for us. And that doesn't mean that, you know, there isn't someone else out there who would kind of need to recreate the same relationship they had with a lost spouse. But speaking individually, that I think has a lot to do with my children not resenting any choices I've made since then.
And that's so important because, you know, they're part of your package.
Well, and that's just it. Yeah. I like the way you put that. But I know that, you know, my friend always respected my home as my children's home, not my home.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
And that maybe they deserved more space there, you know, because that was their space. And, you know, that's probably one of the reasons why we clicked and have this closeness.
Exactly, exactly.
Mm.
And that's so important because there isn't that tension and stress and, you know, expectations.
Yeah.
And it just accepted the fact that this is your home, this is your children's home. And
but boy, you've gotten things out of me today. I would have never thought I would be talking about this today.
Well, I do appreciate it, Laura. Yeah. And I know that our listening audience are just, you know, are sitting back and able to reflect on their own lives, I'm sure. And, you know, maybe they are recent widows or, you know, long-time widows, but just hearing what you're talking about, I know that this is going to spark some thoughts in many of our listeners.
I really hope that it does, yes.
And, Laura, tell our listeners your website address.
Oh, okay. My website is www.laurabhayden, that's LauraBHayden.com.
There you go, listeners. We've been talking to Laura B. Hayden, and her book is Staying Alive, A Love Story. And, you know, as we've listened to her in the last half hour, this has been the love story. And I just really, really encourage you to pick up her book. Again, it's Staying Alive, A Love Story by Laura B. Hayden. Our reviewer loved it. It really brought a lot of memories to her, too. And so I encourage you to do that. Thanks again, Laura.
Thank you, Irene. I really enjoyed talking to you today.
And this is Irene Watson with Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.